just can't do that, Fred.
The recording you've just heard comes from an old-time radio program called Quiet Please. This episode, titled Sketch for a Screenplay, was originally broadcast March the 1st, 1948. The program was written and produced by Willis Cooper, who earlier in his career had created the groundbreaking horror program Lights Out for NBC Radio in the 1930s. Cooper had also been a writer for Orson Welles' Mercury Theater on the Air, as well as its later incarnation, Campbell's Playhouse. Cooper also wrote screenplays for films such as 1939's Son of Frankenstein, as well as the Mr. Moto detective serials. With Orson Welles, Willis Cooper shared a penchant for breaking the established rules of storytelling, in this case, in the medium of radio.
You just can't do that, Fred.
In this case, the problematic narrator, Fred, is played by Ernest Chappell, another alumnus of the Welles Mercury Theater on the Air, in which he had served primarily as an announcer. Chappell serves as the voice of Quiet Please, casually relating Cooper's often unexpectedly complicated stories with a cunning simplicity, or seeming, perhaps even scheming, artifice that he is speaking directly to the radio listener, consciously manipulating the listener through the radio medium's power to project intimacy and interiority. Quiet Please seems to build upon and expand Orson Welles' own idea for a radio program to be called First Person Singular, in which he would not only narrate, but also act out several of the parts within the story. Both Welles' concept and Cooper's seem to be rooted in the aesthetic movement of Impressionism. The idea that the artist, whether writer, painter, musician, or even radio dramatist, seeks ultimately to convey not some mimetic recreation of objective reality according to the dictates of realism, but rather to provide an aperçu into the shifting moods, the fleeting impressions that play upon the artist's mind, and to share with his or her audience a unique rendering of the subjective state of mind, as unique and individualistic and immune to mechanistic replication as Monet's water lilies. Quiet Please is impressionistic radio, mood radio in the most sophisticated sense of the term. It is no accident that Cooper chose for the theme music for Quiet Please the symphony in D minor of the great French impressionist composer César Franck. Sketch for a Screenplay is a deceptively simple story. It begins with a narrator named Fred Arthur, played by Ernest Chappell, reminiscing about his time spent as a screenwriter in Hollywood. Fred gives a realistic portrait of Hollywood during the 1930s and 40s, from the list of actual studios and their locations to the colorful characters who inhabit the city of Hollywood itself.
I wonder if the hardest working newsboy in the world is still on the corner of Hollywood and Vine. Wonder if Roland's still at the parking lot back of the Equitable. And that bartender at the Derby that always used to put the bite on you for $50.
However, what begins as a sentimental journey, a pleasant memoir, soon transforms into an entirely different kind of story. The first of a series of stories within stories, couched within each other like a series of nesting dolls. This is a story of Hollywood as refracted through the mirror of John Barr's funhouse of the imagination, playing upon the notion of Hollywood as a dream factory, where facts are routinely reshaped to fit the story rather than the other way around. Yet Fred's pleasant remembrance of Hollywood is soon disrupted by an ominous tone that seems to undermine the casual realism that has characterized the story up until this point.
Get quite sentimental over Hollywood, especially when you're not there and you're not ever going back.
After such a declaration, one might wonder, where exactly is Fred the narrator? Has the episode located him in a realistic place and specific time? The episode does not answer these questions. Instead, it elides into Fred's carefully constructed daydream of writing a sketch for a screenplay and presenting it to one of his old producer bosses, Harry.
I got to thinking about a screenplay this afternoon when I was thinking about Hollywood. No, it isn't written. I doubt it ever will be written. But I amused myself all afternoon thinking about it. Walking over to Harry's office with a batch of pages under my arm that Lillian had just typed up all nice and neat on the yellow paper.
Fred's literal remembrance of Hollywood has now been transformed, Hollywood style, into a sort of false remembrance. A paradoxically impressionistic realism, including details as specific as the typist Lillian and the neat yellow paper for the imaginary screenplay that will probably never be written and certainly never made, for an imaginary movie that will probably never be made. Unreality is piled upon unreality, and the listener is escorted by Fred into the office of Harry, where he shares his imaginary screenplay with his imagined listener, Harry, and the story, which began with a rather realistic remembrance of Hollywood, is soon transported to an imaginary French countryside, complete with French chateaux.
And after a while, Harry finishes his coke and takes his feet down and shuts his eyes.
All right, what you got, Fred?
I just got a few pages, Harry, just the opening, you see. Only a few scenes, but I think it sets the mood of the thing.
Go ahead, let's hear it. Read it to me.
All right. Long shot, the Chateau Park, summer, day. Shooting from a height toward the chateau itself, which stands at the edge of the woods where the low hills rise against the horizon.
Strikingly, Willis Cooper has his narrator, Fred, use the screenplay format in order to tell the story. The screenplay format is both realistic and unrealistic in effect. It includes detailed descriptions of the chateau and park, yet at the same time, the stage directions, the shot angles, seem to undermine or interrupt or disrupt the realistic reception of the story. One wants to echo to Willis Cooper what Harry says to the storyteller Fred.
You just can't do that, Fred.
At least not in the realistic mimetic tradition of art, in which the goal of the artist is to hide the art, such as stage directions or shot angles, necessary for the making of a film, but not necessary for the viewer's conscious awareness in order that he or she might enjoy the film. Indeed, Willis Cooper's bold, genre-bending stroke of having his radio narrator read from a screenplay collapses the traditional distance between artist and audience. Cooper creates a chimera, a strange hybrid genre, part radio, part film, part written word, and part oral interview. Indeed, the imaginary listener, Harry, participates in the unfolding of the narrative. Frustrated by the welter of seemingly realistic detail, an exasperated Harry finally urges Fred to get on with his story.
The chateau itself is huge, gray, many windowed, and its conical turrets rise bravely against
the... Okay, everybody knows what a French chateau looks like. Go ahead with the story. I gotta go to the barbershop.
Presumably, everyone knows what a French chateau looks like, according to Harry, at least, because they've seen one in a movie, not because they've seen the real thing. And Fred's mega chateau seems more like something from a Douglas Fairbanks adventure movie rather than the actual thing. However, this fanciful setting facilitates the transformation of the story from realistic remembrance to fanciful tale. The tale at first appears to be another realistic remembrance of the child, Fred, living in the halcyon days of pre-World War II France with his two French playmates, Madeleine and Paul. Yet Willis Cooper soon adds another layer of narrative, another frame, to his already multi-layered story. The medieval French epic, La Chanson de Roland, is another story within the story. The Song of Roland is not just another literary allusion or bit of local color. Its narrative shapes and alters the other narratives in which it has been embedded. It also calls into question realism's rationalistic Cartesian divide between the real and the imaginary. For the children, Fred, Paul, and Madeleine, the story of Roland is not a narrative objectified in an ancient text, but rather a living tradition, a living legend which they seek to perpetuate and, subjectively, personify.
We used to sit, the three of us, and dream of Bayard and Roland and Du Guesclin and all the paladins of France whose male ghosts were very near to us in the gathering dusk. Paul.
And Roland blew his horn again and again, but the king was far away and he did not hear.
And Madeleine.
And Roland and all the army died in the Pass of Roncesvalles because King Charlemagne did not hear the horn of Roland.
No, Madeleine. They died. But Roland didn't die.
Well, the book says he died.
No, Roland did not die. Did he, Frey?
The colonel says he didn't die. The colonel says Roland lived forever.
Where is he then?
Roland waits for the day when France needs him. Then he will come.
And the colonel says if we listen on a night when there's no moon sometime, we can hear Roland sounding his horn. Maybe see the flash of his sword Durandal in the starlight.
Oh, do you believe that, Frey?
I don't know. Do you, Paul?
No, of course I believe that. I have heard the horn.
Will you dream then?
I have heard it.
Willis Cooper here breaks the frame of traditional narrative. The Song of Roland is not a story in a book. It's a living legend passed on by an unnamed colonel to the children. And for the children, the art of narrative is not an act of dissociative mimesis, but rather imaginative engagement. The subjective aural experience of Roland's horn blowing forever in the circular time out of time of traditional storytelling, as opposed to the realistic tradition of mimesis built upon the Newtonian construction of time as a straightforward, irreversible flow. Willis Cooper, like his colleague Orson Welles, seems bent on interrupting the chronological flow of narrative, and with it, a static, one-way vision of time itself. Sketch for a Screenplay seems to follow the conventions of chronology, but only to a certain point, and in the end seems to abandon them. In a montage-like series of descriptions, the young Fred leaves behind Paul and Madeleine in France and returns home to the United States. He becomes a journalist and then a successful screenwriter. With the onset of World War II and the fall of France to Nazi Germany, Fred is drawn back to his childhood remembrance of Paul and Madeleine and the Song of Roland.
Double exposure, superimpose the face of a weeping girl. And over the picture, catcher, the sound of a horn echoing from the pass of Roncevant. And again, the face of a weeping girl beside a ruined, shell-torn chateau in France. And a word. One word.
Waiting.
Fred abandons his lucrative job as a screenwriter to join the Army paratroopers. He is one of the first to parachute into France during the 1944 D-Day invasion. The narrative becomes even more complicated as Fred reveals that Harry has himself lost a son to World War II. Harry is no longer the dissociated listener, but becomes integral to the story itself.
And I know what Harry's thinking of. He's thinking about a laughing, talkative young Marine corporal who made one too many landings with the Raiders. And the white Star of David out there on that island with a name nobody can pronounce. And Harry turns back to the screenplay and reads silently for a little while. And then he looks at me.
They won't go for war stories anymore, Fred.
And I don't say anything for a second. But I think... yes, they will go for war stories, Harry. Yes, there's still a lot of people that haven't forgotten. Go on. Read the screenplay, Harry.
Long shot. An airfield in England. Night.
Yes, I remember that.
The objective listener has become a subjective participant. Even though Harry's rationalistic bias wants to pigeonhole or fit into a narrow genre, the sketch as a, quote, war story, his emotional loss forces him to transcend narrow exclusionary definitions and fully engage in the story, not as a listener, but as co-reader. Fred's experience becomes Harry's experience, which leads to a climax not simply of narrative chronology, but of engagement. This occurs when Fred is one of the first soldiers to paratroop into occupied France during the 1944 D-Day invasion.
And nobody yells, Geronimo, but out we go into the blackness below in a night jump in wartime.
Close up. Paratrooper at door of plane.
Close up for me as I brace my hands against the door jams. The darkness is sickening and heavy below me. But when I jump, I'll be too far away from the rest, and the jumpmaster yells at me to hold it, but he's too late. I'm imprisoned in the dark blackness between heaven and earth, alone. Alone in the dark and my heart bursting. I shouted in the darkness, but there was no answer.
The moment is terrifying yet ecstatic. Fred seems to pass out of himself, out of chronological time, out of narrative. Alone, in an all-encompassing existential darkness in which subject and object meet and are one. Fred apparently does safely reach the ground, where he is joined by French resistance fighters, Paul and Madeline. Fred has answered the call of Roland's horn, and together the three attack the Germans who have surrounded Fred's position.
Suddenly there is the crackle of a twig and he leaps to his feet, his Tommy gun at the ready.
Yes, of course, Harry. You guessed it.
A young man and a young woman.
Paul and Madeline.
That's too much of a coincidence, Fred.
It was Paul and Madeline.
Well, Fred?
We said we'd wait, Fred.
Like Harry, the listener has been put into an impossible situation by the narrative. Though the listener can reject the narrative as irrational, Willis Cooper seems to suggest here that it is too late. Like Harry, the listener has been drawn subjectively into the story, or nest of stories, and cannot so easily extricate him or herself.
Two graves with rude headboards. The camera moves in to a close-up and we read the inscription, Madeleine Duclos, French resistance fighter, executed by order of the German commandant. Paul Duclos, French resistance fighter executed. You can't do that, Fred.
But Fred has done that. Willis Cooper has done that. And in a final shock to any vestige left of mimetic logic, a third grave, that of Fred, the narrator, is revealed. The narrative makes no attempt to explain whether its narrator is living or dead. The theme music plays, ending the episode on a note of mimetic impossibility, illogic, and a profound ambiguity about the nature and limitations of stories.